I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Israeli author and activist David Grossman. He's joined in conversation by writer Peter Orner. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces David Grossman and Peter Orner.
David Grossman is one of Israel's preeminent authors and noted activists, and one of the JCCSF's most beloved guests. With 9 novels, a children's opera, multiple books of essays, plays, and 15 children's books, he has explored his country's internal and external landscape in an extraordinarily broad range of styles and genres. His novels, See Under Love, explore the Holocaust through the eyes of a child. In The Yellow Wind, he reported on life in the occupied territories in the 1980s. When the Intifada broke in 1988, his best-selling book was called Prophetic. For 6 months in the 90s, he joined a Jerusalem detective squad several evenings a week to research The Zigzag Kid. Some of you may have seen the film adaptation last summer at the Jewish Film Festival. He then spent the better part of 9 months with homeless teenagers in order to write Someone to Run With. His 2008 book, To the End of the Land, was written partly after the death of his youngest son, Uri, during the war in Lebanon. Since then, he has written a number of poems about the impossibility of mourning a child. He says, quote, "I feel poetry is more the language of grief than prose. Part narrative poem, part Greek tragedy, part Shalom Aleichem, Falling Out of Time consists of an elegiac tapestry of voices, all belonging to bereaved parents." Appearing here in conversation this evening is our other good friend, Peter Orner. His award-winning books include Esther Stories, The Second Coming of Mavala Shikongo, Love and Shame and Love, and most recently, Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Orner and David Grossman.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and thank you all for coming. It's difficult to be moved by a book and then have to get up on stage and express that. And as I was finishing Falling Out of Time, I had this crazy vision of us all being here and everyone in the audience reading the book to themselves. That's impossible. David's come a long way to speak to us. But I hope that gives you some indication of what kind of book we're dealing with here. It's that intimate and that personal, and yet, at the same time, communal. And I think all of these things are things I hope we get into. But first, I wanted to ask David Grossman to read from the book, if that's okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie. Shabbat shalom to all of you. I'll read some pages from the beginning of Falling Out of Time, translated from the Hebrew by Jessica Cohen. Town Chronicler. As they sit eating dinner, the man's face suddenly turns. He thrusts his plate away. Knives and forks clang. He stands up and seems not to know where he is. The woman recoils in her chair. His gaze hovers around her, without talking, without taking hold, and she, wounded already by disaster, senses immediately, it's here again, touching me, its cold fingers on my lips. But what happened? She whispers, with her eyes. Bewildered, the man look at her and speaks, "I have to go." "Where?" "To him." "Where?" "To him, there." "To the place where it happened?" "No, no, there." "What do you mean, there?" "I don't know." "You're scaring me." "Just to see him once more." "But what could you see now? What is left to see?" "I might be able to see him there, maybe even talk to him." "Talk?" Town chronicler. Now they both unfold, awaken. The man speaks again. "Your voice. It's back. Yours too. How I missed your voice. I thought we'd never..." "I missed your voice more than I missed my own." "But what is there?" "There is no such place. There does not exist. If you go there, it does. But you don't come back. No one ever has. Because only the dead have gone. And you, how will you go?" "I will go there alive." "But you won't come back." "Maybe he's waiting for us." "He's not. It's been 5 years and he's still not. He's not. Maybe he's wondering why we gave up on him so quickly the minute they notified us. Look at me. Look into my eyes. What are you doing to us? It's me. Can't you see that this is us, the two of us? This is our home, our kitchen. Come, sit down. I'll give you some soup." "Man, lovely. So lovely the kitchen is. Lovely right now with you ladling soup. Here it's warm and soft, and steam covers the cold window pane." Town chronicler. Perhaps because of the long years of silence, his hoarse voice fades to a whisper. He does not take his eyes off her. He watches so intently that her hand trembles. "Men, and the loveliest of all are your tender, curved arms. Life is here, dear one. I had forgotten. Life is in the place where you ladle soup under the glowing light. You did well to remind me. We are here, and he is there. And a timeless border stands between us. I had forgotten. We are here, and he is... But it's impossible. Impossible. Woman, look at me. No, not with that empty gaze. Stop. Come back to me, to us. It's so easy to forsake us and this light and tender arms and the thought that we have come back to life and that time nonetheless places, thing compresses. Man, no, this is impossible. It's no longer possible that we, that the sun, that the watches, the shops, that the moon, the couples, the tree-lined boulevard turn green, that blood in our vein, that spring and autumn, that people innocently, that things just are, that the children of others, that their brightness and warmness. Woman, be careful. You are saying things. The threads are so fine. Men, at night people came bearing news. They walked a long way, quietly grave, and perhaps as they did so, they stole a taste, a lick. With a child's wonder, they learned they could hold death in their mouths like sweets made of poison, to which they are miraculously immune. We opened the door, this one. We stood here, you and I, shoulder to shoulder, they on the threshold and we facing them, and they mercifully, quietly stood there and gave us the breath of death. Woman, it was awfully quiet. Cold flames lapped around us. I said, I knew tonight you would come. I thought, come, noiseful void, man, from far away I heard you. Don't be afraid, you said. I did not shout when he was born, and I won't shout now either. Woman, our prior life kept growing inside us for a few moments longer. Speech, movements, expressions. Men and women. Now, for a moment, we sink, both not saying the same words, not bewailing him for now, but bewailing the music of our previous life, the wondrously simple, the ease, the face free of wrinkles. Woman, but we promised each other. We swore to be, to ache, to miss him, to live. So what is it now that makes you suddenly tear away? Man, after that night, a stranger came and grasped my shoulders and said, save what is left, fight, try to heal, look into her eyes, cling to her eyes, always her eyes, do not let go. Woman, don't go back there, to those days, do not turn back your gaze. Men, in the darkness I saw one eye weeping and one eye crazed. A human eye extinguished and the eye of a beast half devoured in the predator's mouth, soaked with blood, insane, peered out at me from your eye. Woman, the earth gaped open, gulped us and disgorged. Don't go back there. Do not go, not even one step out of the light. Man, I could not, I dare not look into your eye, the eye of madness, into your nonness. Woman, I did not see you. I did not see a thing. From the human eye or the eye of the beast, my soul was uprooted. It was very cold then, and it is cold now too. Come to sleep. It's late. Men, for 5 years we unspoke that night. You fell mute, then I. For you, the quiet was good, and I felt it clutch at my throat. One after the other, the words died, and we were like a house when the lights go slowly out until a somber silence fell. Woman, and in it I rediscovered you and him. A dark mantle cloaked the three of us, enfolded us with him. And we were mute like him, three embryos conceived by the bane. Men. And together we were born on the other side, without words, without colors. And we learned to live the inverse of life. Thank you.
Thank you very much for reading. I wanted to just start with a fairly basic question, and that is, and I think it's fairly obvious now to the audience, this is has a different form than work people might be familiar with from you. And I wonder if you could speak about the poetry in the book, the dramatic action of the book, etc.
Yeah. It is different because until now I never wrote such a mixture of poems and prose and radio play and maybe even libretto for opera or theater play. I felt that when you write about a violation of the rules of nature even, you know, the right order of things is that parents die before their children. If you describe such a situation, the way you describe it must suit the content. And I was looking for something different and I didn't know what that is. And I started writing it as prose, but it was not accurate enough, I feel. And then suddenly, and I cannot tell you why it happened, but suddenly it was very clear that I need to break the lines, and I need the rhythm of poetry. Maybe I have to start even earlier, you know. Maybe first there was the hesitation whether to write it at all. Because, you know, when you experience a catastrophe, I think the first reaction is to be silent, not to speak. And the first reaction is physical, you know, you want to run to the end of the world or to climb on a roof and to shout your soul out or to dig a hole in the ground like my protagonist here does. And then after a while comes a moment when you feel that you have to give words. You know, I think this is what makes us human, that we try to give names to what we feel and what we think. And the language is such an efficient way of touching life. And the more nuanced the language is, the more nuances of life you touch. And I remember when it happened to us, when we lost our son Uri almost eight years ago, we received lots of letters of condolences from Israel and from out of Israel. And I noticed something, that some of them were written by writers, and writers that I read their books and was stunned by the richness of their language. And when I read the letters, I could not help noticing that all of them wrote in one voice, as if somebody has dictated it to them, and they said, "We are speechless. There are no words to describe something like that." And I thought, yes, I'm also speechless. But after a while, I needed to give my private names to it, because it was either or, either the speechlessness or the clichés in which we always talk about things that are beyond our ability to utter them. You know, both great pleasure and great pain are inexpressible or unexpressible. And I remember that I thought that if I was unfortunate to be sent to this island of exile, which grief is in a way, and it's really an exile from everything I knew beforehand, at least if I have to be there on this island, at least I'll try to map it with my own words, because this is the only way I know how to understand my life in every condition. This is a very extreme one, but okay, this is my way. And then I sat and I wrote it, and after having written it again, I was quite shocked that I was able to write it as the centaur. There is also a centaur in the book. It gets more and more surreal, I know. As the centaur says in the very last lines of the book, that he cannot understand how he dared to write it. Yeah.
You're listening to Israeli author and activist David Grossman, whose latest novel is Falling Out of Time. He's joined in conversation by writer Peter Orner on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You're somebody who has faith in the power of words to convey emotion, and that's you know your whole life has been much devoted to that. And it seems that the tension in this book between words that can't quite convey what you desperately need them to convey versus the need to do it. And I'm wondering if the book is as much about the act of writing itself as a way of trying. I'm wondering if you could talk about the book as a you know, in the centaur character being prominent in that, about writing itself being a powerful force in the book.
There is a journey in the book. After the conversation between the man and the woman, it's, as you understood, it's a kind of a very Haimish situation of a man and a woman, and they sit quietly because later we realize that they didn't speak a word in the last 5 years since they lost their son. And the man says, I have to go there, and he cannot explain what is there. And he begs her to come with him. He needs her. He loves her. He wants her to be with him in this journey. And she refuses. She says, you're not going there to him. You're going, in a way, out of your mind. And I will not follow you there because for 5 years, day and night, I bite my flesh in order not to lose my mind. And he leaves the little hut where they live, and he stands in front of the hut and he starts to encircle himself with small steps, and then his feet leads him and he circles the little hut where they live and the little village. And the next thing we find him walking on the tip of the hill, the top of the tip, how do you say, of the hills, and around the big city. And he walks. Now, he walks pointlessly. There is not any target to where, or physical target. Mm-hmm. He wants to get as close as possible to the place where the living ones can still touch the dead, can still feel the warmth and vitality of those whom they have lost. And his walk, this magical circle that he does around the city, like the circling of Jericho, for example, that mm-hmm. made the walls of Jericho fall, this walk starts to attract people from within the city who are in the same position, who are paralyzed by their own catastrophe. And they are magneted to him. They cannot resist him. They are really magneted from their life, from kitchens and bedrooms and wherever. And the palace itself, the Duke also follows him. And when they start to walk, suddenly they are able to start to talk after years of being totally silent or stammering or all kind of being mute. And for me, this book, more than everything else, is a trip to find, or a journey to find, a way to talk about this, about the things that are, that cannot be uttered.
As I was reading it, there's a line from William James that I've always been stunned by, and he says something to the effect of, if we knew all of the personal tragic dramas in people's lives in one city, if you could possibly have that, your head would explode. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, Mr. James. But it occurred to me that when the other bereaved parents join the walking man, that it was some way of getting out of the exile of grief. Would that,
I think,
in some way?
When they are together, they are able to share something that only people in this situation can share and can understand. But even so, after all, grief is a very isolating human predicament. There is something that isolates you and put yourself in front of what has happened, and not only in front of that, but in front of death. It really creates new relation, new understanding of the living and death. Now, it's very hard to articulate it, but I think when you allow yourself to be exposed to that, you feel the intensity of both life and death in such an immense, strong way that I have never experienced before. I also thought, you know, nobody knows what exists there on the other side. Yes, I'm not a believer, so I cannot take any comfort from believing in Olam Haba, in afterlife, in the next, in paradise or hell. I can take some comfort that there is good hell somewhere. Yeah, but But nobody really, I mean, 2 or 3 millions of years that man lives on this earth, and nobody really knows what is there. But I think when I wrote it, I got a glimpse of something that, for a non-believer, there is really one way to get the feeling of what is there, to, you know, to scratch a little this hermetic, monolithic envelope of over there. And this is the way of art, of writing prose or poetry or making music or theater or cinema, whatever. Art, after all, if it's serious, this is one of the very few places where life and death coexist simultaneously. Life and loss of life coexist simultaneously. And I think that if we think of every serious piece of art that we have experienced, read or listened to or saw on stage, it always has had or has to do with this proximity of life and death, where these two are radiating towards each other.
There's humor in this book, and
should be.
I wanted to share a small passage between the Centaur and the Town Chronicler. Centaur says the Town Chronicler is taking notes. He's actually going out into the village and getting into people's private space and asking questions. And the Centaur says to him, "You again? Won't you ever shut up? Tell me about the soccer ball, about the cowboy hat, about birthdays. Tell me about them, about the magician's wand, the blue kite." And then the Centaur, that was the Town Chronicler, the Centaur, "Junk, memory husks, Town Chronicler. At least tell me something about the cradle." The Centaur says, "How about you tell me something about yourself for a change?" And the shift in the book in that particular moment, again, this idea of grief, not of being so individual, and yet these are two actually bereaved parents coming at it from a completely different direction. The Town Chronicler being somebody who is completely trapped and can't speak at all, and the Centaur, who is, we should say, half man, half desk. In this case,
half writer, half writing
right.
desk.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. He wanted to write about his own grief, and he cannot write, and he cannot not write. And after some years, he assimilated with his writing desk, which for some people is hell. I find it like paradise.
I wanted to. Go back to this idea of walking again, just to ask a question. I mean, do you think that, and this is not the first time in your books where people walk at night. It's a motif that occurs a lot and strikes me. And I wonder if what you have to say about the physical act of walking and how it might relate to how we might, I don't know if we can walk, we certainly can't walk off grief, but is it a, do you think it's a way of handling?
I'm a walker, to start with that. I mean, I start every morning at 5:45, walking 5 kilometers with my wife and a couple of friends and a dog, which is really essential. almost in all my books, there is a jogger or a swimmer mm-hmm. or a walker. I need that. I mean, when I write, by the way, I'm walking. I cannot sit. It's strange, but I try to make myself sit, and then I have an idea, and I find myself walking very rapidly. Sometimes it's in one quite small room, but I need to... My wife says that I leave marks of burns on the carpet, like a prisoner, you know. But of course, in this book, there is another dimension to it, because... You know, the nature of a catastrophe is that it paralyzes you. It has the ability to paralyze you and to make you helpless and apathetic. And I felt I cannot accept it. I know it sounds strange, but I believe that being an artist, being a writer, being an artist, is being able to constantly move. And I felt, you know, even kind of an insult to be paralyzed by that. And I needed that in the book that I write about it, it will be full with movement, with flexibility, with the ability to look at things from different points of view. And I, you know, I think that in so many of my books, I wrote about an individual that is facing an outer arbitrariness, and he or she is paralyzed because of that. You know, let it be the arbitrariness of that the body has upon our soul, or the maybe ultimate arbitrariness of the Nazis during the Shoah. Or I wrote a lot, and I mean, since it's obvious, I will say twice, there is no comparison. I wrote a lot about the occupation that we live in Israel between us and the Palestinians. I try to understand what happens to an individual who is crushed by such strong arbitrariness. And I learned that when I write about it, when I find new words to describe the gap between me as an individual and this outer, faceless arbitrariness, by the very fact that I wrote about it, something has changed. I no more stand in the place where I was before I started writing. And my relationship with this arbitrariness have changed. And maybe I also discovered some cracks within this arbitrariness. And also here, when I tried to write about, you know, this, yes, arbitrariness that mm-hmm. befell on my family's life, the need not to be defined by catastrophe, yes, and I really think that, you know, sometimes the only liberty that one has is to describe his own tragedy with his own words, mm-hmm. not with words that others try to impose on him.
You talk about these forces, these arbitrary forces, and it seems that in much of your work in this book too, domesticity, you know, kind of the comforts of home, you know, the soup, the town chronicler's wife's shoulder. He loves his wife's shoulder, even though they haven't spoken in a very long time. And I think Into the End of the Land, when an offer makes the bed, you know, he's constructing this bed for his parents. I wonder if is that, do you think that domesticity is sort of some bulwark against these political forces? I mean, I know it's not going to save us, but you know, it seems that I go back again in your work to that idea that you know, that the comforts of family versus you know, certain responsibilities that you have to do, and that's such a tragic choice oftentimes. But
yeah, I'm a very domestic person. And I think, I know it's strange to say it here on stage, but I'm a very private person in my life, really. And there's such power and comfort in domesticity, in routine, in everydayness, especially when reality around us is so unexpected, unpredictable, violent, not understandable even. But even if I don't think of our reality in Israel, even when I think about history, I believe that the most important moments in the history of mankind, they have not occurred on battlefields or in palaces or in parliaments, but rather in bedrooms and kitchens mm-hmm. and children rooms. And I think even when you write a book that kind of an epos of the history of Israel or the life of Israel, the best way for me to touch it is through the small particles mm-hmm. of home, of relationship between a man and a woman, parents and their children. And these are things that I understand. I understand them much more than I understand politics or, you know, the roots of the conflict or all these big words. Mm-hmm. And even when I write articles about the situation, in most times I will try to filter it through the eyes of people who are trapped in this situation. I really think, you know, the real tragic aspect of our conflict in the Middle East is that we are all trapped there, sometimes or most times even against our will. And we are lost. We are lost. And when I say we, I mean we and the Palestinians. We really are lost in a way that, I mean, we need a hand to guide us out of it. Behind all the arguments and the debates and all that, you look at the people and you see lost people who are trapped in an impossible situation. People who try to live normal life in a totally abnormal situation. It's like sometimes I compare it, you know, to someone who tries to take a little candle in the middle of a thunderstorm, you know, and to keep it mm-hmm. lightning.
Mm-hmm. In one of your essays, you quote Italian writer Natalia Ginzburg, and you say that as soon as one writes, one miraculously ignores the rest of the circumstances of one's life. And I wanted to bring it back to the falling out of time in the sense that there's a merging that, and I don't want to give away the end by any means, but it's I wonder if you could speak to the way that private pain becomes, you know, universal among the walkers.
Yeah. Some of it I think I mentioned before about solidarity on the one hand and isolation on the other hand. But may I answer from another point of view now
sure.
that you bring it up? I
yeah.
thought, you know, in Israel, and we are just 3-4 days after the National Memorial Day for the soldiers who died in wars. In Israel, the culture and the ceremonies and the state of mind of people are so much defined by the deaths of so many, many soldiers. And it's important, I guess, for a country who is deep in war for more than a century. Even though Israel is only 66 years old, but still, I mean, there is this tradition of violence that we are immersed in, that is directed at us and that we turn towards our neighbors. And since we lost our son in war, I had the chance to look how this mechanism works. And I think that the more the country feels guilty for the death of these soldiers, the more it tends to glorify them, to idealize them. It needs that. And I felt that, you know, when a soldier dies, immediately he's being nationalized. Mm-hmm. He belongs to the nation. And for me, writing this book was also to reclaim the privacy and the intimacy of this occurrence.
It's one of the most moving passages, and I thought I would read it as we start to close. Walking man, At least we parted without anger. I told him, and without resentment, you loved us and were loved. Seems to speak very directly to that reclamation you speak of.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Israeli author and activist David Grossman, whose latest novel is Falling Out of Time. He's joined in conversation by writer Peter Orner. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I wanted to ask you, and it's related to much of what you've been talking about, but what is it like for you to be a fiction writer, and as well as a nonfiction writer and a journalist, who definitely is not afraid to wade into politics and writes about it? But I wonder, what is it like for you to be asked political questions as if there's a lot of minds working on this problem, and you're often called upon to come up with answers. What kind of pressure do you feel when you're faced with people asking you, what should we do?
First, let me be very clear. I so much more prefer to write fiction than nonfiction, and there is such sweetness in inventing a whole world. You know, I'm now about to finish another novel that I'm writing, and I think it's such a great thing that you can create this being that acts harmoniously with all its parts and particles and all the relationship between all these imaginary characters. They function like in a healthy body. Very soon I will experience the sadness of parting and going next to the next book. But right now, I still take this real pleasure of being with it and being surprised by it. And there is something so total about writing a novel. When you write nonfiction, you come to a reality that exists. Mm-hmm. You don't have to invent it. I mean, you can, of course, invent it in the way you describe it. If you find new nuances in it, you invent part of it. If you allow some contents that until then were hidden, you allow them to surface, you create something there. It's a creative description of reality. But nothing can be compared to the totality of writing a novel that you have. You know, I sometimes think of it like hiding a family of 50 members under the ground in a cellar in your backyard during a war, and they cannot go out, and nobody knows who is there, and you are the only one. You have to go every day, once or twice, and you have to talk with them and to listen to them and to ventilate them a little, and to you do it, and to tell them about the progress of the war and the chances of them to be saved. Mm-hmm. And you also have to take out their 90 pots, yes, because you have to do it. You have to do the lowest and the highest, the loftiest human actions, and you have to prevail in all the layers between this and that. And it's really a sense of not responsibility is too a weak word for it, because it's a way of being. I mean, so much of my life is hidden because of that, you know, because I mean, okay, my wife, some friends, they know generally what I'm doing, but the main thing, the activity, the whole life that takes place while one, you know it as a writer. You know it. You know it's boiling all the time, and it's only yours. Because I mean, Yoshua or Amos Oz will not volunteer to write my stories, and vice versa. They are not relevant to them. And about being asked, you know, I think I look at our reality also as a writer. I mean, trying to look at it from different points of view. I think usually politicians are trapped in one point of view. Mm-hmm. and they are unable to liberate themselves. And it's so dangerous because in this situation, not only that they will not be prepared for signs of peace, but they will not be prepared for signs of war as well, because they are trapped. And the heart of writing is the ability to move all the time, to move between different points of view, and to try to envelop every given situation. You know, if I had to write a novel about our conversation here, so I'll write it from maybe from my point of view, and then from your point of view, and from your point of view, and your, and from you telling your 4-year-old daughter about how it was here, and maybe your dog is eavesdropping on it.
She would be. She would be.
The more you envelop this reality, the more you get real, the more you touch reality. Even when I write political articles, there is also the function of the language, the need to be accurate in language, not to allow all those big systems who have such a strong interest in manipulating the language, you know, the government and the media and the army and our fears and our enemies. All these are big systems that try to manipulate the language, and it's so important to be accurate in it.
And there's a moment that has stayed with me for a long time, and that's towards the end of To the End of the Land. There's a moment where Aura remembers having argued with Offer, telling him never shoot to hurt anybody, which is a beautiful thing for a mother to say, but for a soldier to hear, especially where he is going, it's maybe not the most practical advice. And it struck me as being a great moment of how fiction complicates things that, you know, that a commander would never entertain in the world. Of course, it's unworkable, but it struck me as being a great example of, you know, what a mother can say over a general.
Yeah. And a father, if I may say. Yeah. I also said it to both of my sons, and I stand behind it. But of course, there is always the question that you just now described. You know, maybe by planting this doubt within him, he might not function well at the moment of truth, so to say, yes? And this is, I think, in a small scale, really the big dilemma of our being there, especially as parents. I mean, on the one hand, we want to raise up our children to be, you know, open and humanist and giving trust in people, liberal, dialogical. But at the same time, we live in a reality that defies all the above. And in order to function well in this sometimes catastrophe zone of the Middle East, maybe all these qualities that I try to educate my children on were not adequate. This is, again, a deep question of how to remain a mensch in such an unmensch situation.
There's a line, towards the end of this book, there's a line that I wanted to also point out, and that is that when the walkers and the group of walkers, the teacher and the chronicler and the net mender and the duke, who have a nice, you all need to read this, but they couple off, these walkers. But there's a line, there is breath inside the pain. There's breath inside the pain. And that, it struck me that, you know, that much of the book goes towards an opening in the grief, that it's never going to end, but there's breath inside it.
Yeah. Yes, I can testify only for myself, because I know how difficult it is to breathe within the pain of grief. And yet I think there are ways to be able to do it. This is not a how-to-do book, how to breathe within grief. No, not at all. But I can say that for myself, writing it, creating a place and even a home for me in a world that became so much of an exile, there was a kind of a small not really tikkun, but doing something right in a world that turned to be all wrong. And I gave this line to a child, that this is his only appearance in the book. Suddenly there is a child in the room of the Sun Tower, and he says, "Yesh neshima betoch hakev, yesh neshima betoch hakev." There is a breath within pain. And you know, if you allow yourself to breathe, if you understand that all that you can do in such situation of grief is to try to remember without dying of it, and to forget without killing, to find this very subtle balance. You have to work very hard in grief. It's nothing taken for granted, and it needs a very intended and opinionated effort all the time in order to act against the gravity of grief. I think if we allow ourselves to do it, each one in his or her own way, and every one of us has experienced a loss of someone who is dear to him or to her, we might feel that we are no more victims in the way that we were beforehand. That we are, as I said, we are not helpless, not passive, not victims. We cannot reverse the events, of course, but we can stand in a somewhat different place where we stood before.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just so moved when you said about being in the Middle East, that we are all lost and we need a hand to guide us out. And I was thinking about how in your book you wrote, you're really writing into grief as a way of getting to some kind of transformation. And, paradoxically, at the core of this lostness that you're talking about in the Middle East, it seems to me about grief gone awry. And I wonder, I think you must have thought very deeply about grief gone awry into violence, and I wonder if you might share some of your thoughts about that with us.
You know, one can take both ways from grief. The most accessible way is the way of revenge, rage, hate. Since my ultimate goal is that there will be peace between us and the Palestinians, and that both peoples will get the privilege to explore some normalcy and just to be, with capital B, not only to survive from one catastrophe to another. I refused from the very first moment to yield to hatred and to rage. I had my moments, of course, but I don't think it will lead, this way will lead us to a fruitful or productive solution. Only more and more people will be swept into this circle of victims and families of victims, and haters and violent people. Sometimes it's really hard to see how violence is accessible, how fears are accessible. I think we have a prime minister who is a genius in manipulating our fears, because Mr. Netanyahu is really, really an expert in staring together the real dangers that Israel faces, and it faces real dangers, but he manages to confuse them with the echoes of past trauma. And we, as a traumatized nation, traumatized community, we are helpless in front of such manipulation. And we are almost programmed to act through fears and through suspicion and through hatred. I don't think that I ever heard from Mr. Netanyahu a word of vision. He is in office more now, more than David Ben-Gurion was. And never, never I've heard from him a word of vision of what peace might bring to us, only regarding the impossibility of peace or the dangers of peace or the way they are going, that the Palestinians are going to trick us and to trap us if, God forbid, there is peace. And, you know, if you do not allow people to believe that there might be another option for them, if you only promise them more and more of the same tragedy, if you do not create within people some agents of positive thought regarding what can peace bring to us, and I'm not talking about the solutions, the territorial solution, or the question of security, of water, all these are very important things. I'm talking about a new way to be in this life, a way to be in life that are not dictated heavily by fear of death constantly, about being in life and believing that we have a future, because right now, tell you frankly, I think most Israelis, deep in their hearts, do not really believe that Israel has a future. And it's so heartbreaking to see such a creative and strong and ambitious and intelligent society acts against its own interests constantly for decades, because we are unable to transgress, to be beyond or above, I think I used the wrong word, I don't know. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah? I'm gonna say that we're out of time at this point, I'm sorry. But please join me in saying thank you both to Peter Orner and to David Grossman.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Israeli author and activist David Grossman, whose latest novel is Falling Out of Time. He was joined in conversation by writer Peter Orner. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Chris Howell. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rosh Hanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature American policymaker and former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.